So continue to do that as you hit them.
Is there any questions about the chapter 2, which we're done with basically now? Something we haven't done that you need in the assignment is
what we're about to do, which is really, I think you know already, it's how do you relate matrix elements of the Hamiltonian to scattering amplitudes? No, I just, if I could get the second, if I get a second neuron going there, and I could have a synapse working up, and then then I'll be firing. Sorry, a little bit slow today. So if there's no questions, then I'll jump right in. So
so we're going to do chapter 3 in like 3 minutes.
And the main thing with chapter 3 is you're trying to, chapter 3 is basically, you spend a whole bunch of time figuring out what the standard model of Lagrangian is. But what you want to do is calculate things like decay rates and scattering cross sections. So chapter 3 is the bridge where it's just reminding you what the connection is between scattering cross sections and decay amplitudes, or decay rates, and matrix elements of the Hamiltonian. And so it's just, you know, time-dependent perturbation theory applied to scattering. And the basic thought, you know, this is nothing that you haven't seen in quantum mechanics classes, I think, but it's, you know, the basic thought, collisions are like life, right? There's vast periods of time when nothing happens, and then something exciting happens, and then there's vast periods of time when nothing happens. And so and you spend most of your time talking about the exciting part. So in scattering, you know, you've got some event happens in here, but so there's two things come together, say, and then they separate. And the upshot is that they're basically evolving like free particles. So the trajectories, if you actually followed them, would do something like that, maybe. But for vast parts of the time, they're really looking like they're non-interacting particles, because really they're wave packets, and the wave packets haven't overlapped. And even though the interactions are always there, if the wave packets don't overlap, then they don't know that there's a collision going on. And so, you know, you define these scattering states, which I'll denote with double angles here. These are exact states of the Hamiltonian, which are being, whose evolution under the full Hamiltonian is the thing that's supposed to be agreeing very well with that. You know, the full evolution here is very close to a non-interacting evolution where nothing happens. And then later on, it's very close to another non-interacting interaction or evolution where nothing happens. And so at the initial time, in the remote past, you ask that for t, you know, goes to minus infinity, that the evolution of this exact state is behaving like the free evolution of some other state, labeled by the same things. Alpha could be momentum or whatever you like. And this would be the incoming state, because we're doing this in the remote past. And then there's a similarly an outgoing state, which is, let's say, beta out, whose real exact evolution is equal to, for large times, t goes to plus infinity, equal to the free evolution of some other state. And so then, you know, what you're interested in is the amplitude, likelihood of getting this, given you started with this. So you're interested in things like beta out, given that you started off with alpha in. And the whole idea of the S matrix is that you can relate that to these basis states just by inverting everything here. If I multiply through here by e to the iht, then you know, this says that alpha out. Oh yeah, that was a beta, sorry. This is gonna be an expensive day, I can tell. One reason I'm kind of only firing on half cylinders, and also I don't have any pennies. All right. So the bottom line is, if I imagine I could call this, I guess, omega of t comes alpha, where the out is t goes to infinity, and if I did the same thing for the in states, it'd be t goes to minus infinity, where omega, if I just look at that, is e to the I h t, e to the minus I h naught t, right? So this thing would be beta s alpha, where s is just going to have to be omega star of infinity is omega of minus infinity. Where? Yeah, here, as long as it's the same on both sides, it's the same. Okay. So the bottom line is you want this thing. And the way, traditionally, the way you do this in time-dependent perturbation theory is you set up a differential equation for this thing for finite time. So if you define u of t prime to be omega t star omega t prime, then if you plug in the definition, that's if I take star, I guess I'm going to have e to the I h naught t e to the minus I h t e to the I h t. So that's e to the, I don't want to write this. I want to write it just like that. Good. Minus I h t minus t prime, yeah. There's t primes I forgot to write here. So the point is that you can usefully write this thing. If you take du dt, right, what are you going to do? You're going to pull down a, so we'll have e to the I h naught t times I h naught from this term, and I'm going to have a minus I h from that term, e to the I h t minus I h t. So if I had, you know, if I've written h implicitly here, I've knew what I meant by the non-interacting bits and the interacting bits. The difference is v, and if I define v of t to just be, you know, so what I have here is basically minus I v, right? So they've got h minus h naught. So if I slap in an e to the I h t on both sides, so if I take e to the I h naught t v e to the minus h naught t, then what I've got here is minus I v of t times u again. Which line are we talking about here? Here?
Well, here too. If you go back to the
point. Okay. No, I think it's okay. Because omega was defined by multiplying everything through by e to the IHT to put this on the other side. That's where this came from. And then if I take omega star, I'm going to get that. And then that's omega. Throw me that dime back. I'm just joking. No, you can keep the dime. So So this is the interacting, and what I'm really doing here is this is the interaction representation of the operator V. So effectively what we're doing here is we're working in a representation where we're evolving the states with the interaction term, and the operators are being evolved with the non-interacting Hamiltonian. That defines the interaction representation. And that's why this particular thing is normally V isn't time dependent, but we're making it time dependent because we're writing it in the interaction representation where we're evolving all the operators in terms of H naught. So the point of this exercise is that once you've gotten this far, then you can write in perturbation theory, this thing can be integrated because you can iterate the, if I plug in the solution on the right-hand side, I want to use a, sorry. So the solution formally to this equation, which I get by iterating it, is that gives me a series for V, and it's going to be that U of T prime. And I'm going to use a boundary condition here, which is when T and T prime are equal to each other, I want this to be the unitary matrix, because if T and T prime are equal to each other, then, this is this and this. These omegas are basically unitary matrices because the products are unitary matrices. And so I have this as an initial condition. And so with that initial condition, I'm going to get that U is minus I let me get this right now. Let's go from T to T prime tau V of tau U. I squared T to T prime T tau 1 integral. That's right, T prime T is what I wanted to do there. T prime to tau 1 T tau 2 V of tau V of tau 2. The nth term here is going to be minus I to the n integral t prime t d tau 1 integral from tau n minus 1 d tau n. Let me see if I got that right. Oh, once I don't need the U's here anymore, right? So I've got two steps here. If I stopped here, I've got a solution to this equation. So if I plug it in again, I get the next term. And so if I go to infinite order, I don't need the U's anymore. I didn't need those. That was what was looking weird. So that's a formal solution to what U would be as a series in V. And so if we're interested in the matrix elements of S between alpha, two states, in our case, what's nice about this is that we've got the operators evolving using the free equations of motion. That means the fields are the operators. They're evolving using the free equations of motion. We know what those operators are because we know everything there is to know about free fields. So you explicitly know what all the fields are in terms of creation annihilation operators because they're evolving with the free evolution. So matrix elements of this thing are easy to calculate because we know what the interaction Hamiltonian is in terms of the fields. We know what the fields are in terms of the creation annihilation operators. So any matrix element we want to take here, we can take just by applying the general rules for how creation annihilation operators create and destroy particles. So that's the utility of that expression, but it's not quite so useful yet. What we really want is these things taken to infinity. So S is going to be, first step is easy. It's just going to be 1 minus I integral minus infinity to infinity d tau, d tau. on. But having these nested limits of integration sucks from the point of view of, you know, for instance, if you're interested in the Lorentz invariance of this answer, it'll be more convenient if we had had the integral. You know, given that these interaction Hamiltonians are going to be the integral d3x of something else, of the Hamiltonian density, every time we do a time integral, we're going to combine it with a space integral and get an integral d4x and get something which looks like it's something which is got a hope of being Lorentz invariant. But that's would have been true if we'd been integrating from minus infinity to infinity, because that's what we're doing in the spatial directions too. And so it's convenient to get rid of these upper limits of integration. And the simplest way to do that is just to take advantage of an identity. So the identity is defines time ordering. So there's the identity at the, let me say this. Sorry, first I have a definition, then I have an identity. So definition. Time ordering of a bunch of things. So V of tau 1, tau n. Just means order them out with the latest in front of the earliest. Because that's what we have, essentially have here. We always have this is being designed that tau 1 is there before tau 2, because we're integrating it up to tau 1. So the ordering here is that this is the earliest, this is the latest. So we want to have a definition which means that. If I give you a bunch of randomly ordered t's here, tau's, this will just mean order them in the right way. And a formal way to write that is to write them in all possible orders with a step function which turns off the contribution if the order is wrong.
So that's what the 317 is telling you. So what we'll do is,
the definition is that this is tau latest, tau next latest, tau earliest. But a way of writing that is sum over all permutations of these tau's of V of tau, the permutation of one, permutation of n, times a step function which turns it off unless all these tau's do the right thing. So I have to have, for this to survive, I need a step function where tau permutation of one is bigger than tau permutation of two, and a step function which says that, you know, for all of them, the n minus one one is later than the nth one, where, you know, theta of x is just one if x is positive, zero if x is negative. So this is just a formal way of writing this, because these step functions just say that if I've ordered them the wrong way, one of these step functions is going to be have a negative argument and then a zero. So, and the reason that's useful is that there's an identity that the integral from minus infinity to infinity d tau 1, minus infinity to tau 1, d tau 2, infinity to tau n minus 1, d tau n. That's just 1 over n factorial times integral from minus infinity to infinity d tau 1. So all the limits here are just going from minus infinity to infinity of the time ordering of v of tau 1, v of tau n. So if I do the integral over this thing, I'm just going to get, what's going to happen is that the integral of this thing over all times, from plus infinity to minus infinity, there's always going to be a range of integration which picks off the right order, is what's happening here. And so if you think about plugging this definition into here, what will happen is that I can always do a change of integration variable from tau 1, tau 2, tau 3, to tau n, to the permuted one, tau p1, tau p2, tau pn. And then, once I've done that change of integration variable, every term in the sum is exactly the same, because I'm integrating over the same arguments, the same thing. And the step functions, all they're going to do is enforce these limits, that you integrate from over the range where tau n is the earliest and tau n minus 1 is the next earliest, and so on. So what happens is if I integrate this thing, I get the same contribution. I get this thing from every term in the sum, and there's n factorial terms in the sum because there's n factorial ways of permuting n things, and that's why I had to divide by n factorial there. So the point of that is that you can just replace this integral here by the integral with the limits of integration being minus infinity to infinity, provided you divide by n factorial and time order the interaction Hamiltonians, with this being the definition of time ordering. So that allows you to write this as just one plus sum. Or I could just do the whole thing, I guess, as a sum. Sum n equals 0 to infinity of minus I to the n over n factorial. So that's the famous expression that we're using. So the time ordering is going to complicate the odd thing because it's going to be the one thing that that shows you that if V is the integral d3x of some Hamiltonian interaction Hamiltonian density, then another way of writing that same thing is we have some 0 to infinity of d4x minus infinity. Now we're writing the time ordered product of these interaction Hamiltonians. So this looks nice in Lorentz invariant. This is nice in Lorentz invariant. If this were the Lagrangian density rather than the Hamiltonian density, it would also be Lorentz invariant. For covariate, what's being integrated over x, it would be an invariant. The time ordering would be the only thing you'd worry about, is the failure of Lorentz covariance. And as one of the exercises shows you, there's an interesting cancellation that happens in the failure of the time ordering to be covariant cancels the difference between h and minus l, the Lagrangian. And so effectively, there's a long song and dance which shows that the, morally speaking, this is the same thing as replacing H with minus the interaction Lagrangian. And there's a slightly different ordering that goes on here, which is defined in the exercise that you do, and it's I'll get to when I get to it. So that's the first part of the story. The kinds of things that we're trying to calculate, transition matrix elements, have been related to matrix elements of this thing S. S has been related to the interaction Hamiltonian, which we know what it is in great detail for the standard model. and we know how to take those matrix elements between particle states. So in principle, we're in business. All we're missing is there's one more technical step because I treated these things as if they were not wave packets, but that they were really energy eigenstates. And that's just kind of the trick that you do in quantum mechanics, which is a bit of a lie, because the whole story of scattering was that you had a wave packet. And the reason things weren't interacting all the time was that they were wave packets that didn't overlap until they got to the interesting region. If you really took the infinite limit of an exact momentum eigenstate, then these things are not wave packets. They extend throughout all space, and so they never stop interacting with each other. So the whole pretense of having interactions happening only here starts to fail. And similarly, if they're energy eigenstates, then you can't have them, same words in the time direction. When I think of these things as being evolving as just a phase in time, which I didn't make explicit here, but which is what you typically do when you're thinking of these states. When you think of particle states, we're thinking of energy eigenstates and momentum eigenstates. And these things, strictly speaking, were supposed to be packets. And so if you use momentum eigenstates and energy eigenstates, what you find is that you run into problems, and you run into problems because of this conceptual point I'm making here that you really weren't allowed in a scattering problem to use plane waves. You had to really use wave packets. And the resolution is exactly what it was in when you did this as an undergraduate for quantum mechanics. This is not a field theory story. This is a quantum mechanics story. know, the problem comes down to that if you calculate S, one thing you'll learn is that it conserves energy and momentum. So if you have a translation invariant matrix element, you know, so if H interaction is translation invariant, and we can, or if we're allowed to, we can normally write this being e to the I p mu x mu times H interaction at zero. So we can evolve in time and we can evolve in space the operator using the translation operators in time and space, whose generators are momentum and energy. If we plug that into here, we can make explicit a lot of the X dependence. I don't know how detailed I want to get here. And if I put in e to the ipx, e to the minus ipx on all these guys, and insert a complete set of states between all these operators, then all those states will be energy eigenstates, and we can extract the X dependence explicitly as being the energies of all the particles involved here. And then the overall, you know, given that we know the energies of the initial and final states, the bottom line will be that the overall center of mass, essentially, one of these integrals over X will be doable. It's not going to depend at all on this matrix element. It's going to only depend on, the integrand will only be e to the I sum over momenta, this particular coordinate. So the integral over the coordinate is going to just give you the delta function, which expresses energy and momentum conservation. So let me just cut to the chase on that. Let me say that an argument along these lines implies that matrix elements are typically have the form of, they're proportional to delta to the fourth of the momentum in beta minus momentum in alpha, or the form momenta, times some matrix element. Traditionally, we'll put in a 2 pi to the fourth here, factor of I, and times the matrix element. And the technical problem that happens is that if you're going to square this thing, to get probabilities, you want to square this thing. And so if you square this thing, the problem's going to be that you're going to get 2 factors of this delta function. And so then that's a problem. You want one factor to express the fact that the k rates also conserve momentum. But the other factor is now being evaluated at 0. Because if you have 2 delta functions of the same argument, the second one can always be replaced with 0 because the first one enforces that p alpha is equal to p beta. And that delta function you're getting is saying something's wrong with your calculation. The thing that's wrong with your calculation is that you're doing it with plane waves and not with packets. And so if you fix the packets and you do this with packets, you don't have this problem. So there's a song and dance in chapter 3 which uses a trick which takes advantage of the fact that you know the whole packet story is going on to extract out the right, what the transition probabilities become if you're careful about how these wave packets interact with one another. And the bottom line is that when you scatter things from each other, the total probability depends a little bit on the initial wave functions, so there's depends how you prepare the state. And then there's a part which just depends on the reactions, and it doesn't depend on the details of how you prepare the state. And the total probability of the reaction tends to be the product of those two things. You have to first bring these things together with some probability times the probability of them scattering once they were together. And so it's useful to define the cross-section, which is the thing that doesn't depend on how you start off the particles. It just depends on how they interacted. And once you define that, there's a direct connection between that and this matrix element M, which the chapter 3 beats on and derives for you in a kind of a bit of an arcane way. And that's why I'm just going to write that down now, because this is really not a field theory story. This is a quantum mechanics story, and I suspect you've all seen it before. So actually, and that's something that I should ask about. Who has taken scattering in a quantum mechanics class as an undergraduate here? So I would have thought that a lot of you would have done. It sounds like you have. And so have you seen this kind of song and dance in that scattering class? It's often true that that's the thing that's taught the least well in a scattering class. Because it's one of these many things in physics which is like Jesus dying for your sins. You know, it's good that somebody did it once, but you don't want to have to be doing it every day. You want to use the answer at some point. And so people normally want to know, you know, what the connection is between the probabilities and the matrix elements. Without this argument, once you know that it's true, you don't really need to use it, you know, every time you're trying to calculate a scattering rate. And so, so it's often true. That's one of the things that people don't teach very well. So there's a, you know, an exposition at some level in chapter 3, which is based largely on Weinberg's treatment of it. But there are a lot of good books on this, you know, there's some of which are listed in the appendix. So let me cut to the chase. Bottom line is, we're mostly interested in a case where alpha involves one or two particles, and beta can involve as many as you like. So when alpha involves one particle, that's when you have a decay process. One particle comes in, then, you know, goes into something. And when alpha involves two particles, then they collided, and then, poof, they go into something else. So let me do that, those two cases. So let me now make sure that I've normalized things the way the book normalizes them. Yeah. So now, in the book, this is actually minus I. And then the thing I didn't write here was there's also some amplitude that nothing happens. So that's often written separately. So delta alpha minus beta is the statement that nothing happens. And the M is now capturing the piece where something did happen. So with this definition and these factors of I and 2 pi, then if alpha is a one particle state, then its decay rate, so this is morally this matrix element squared up to factors which are taking care of this property that we're not using wave packets properly here. So that rate for alpha, the rate for alpha goes to this. This is the probability per unit time the reason that we're calculating a rate rather than a probability is that if you're thinking of this thing being close to being a prob, the wave packet story was a momentum story. The corresponding story for using energy eigenstates is that an energy eigenstate, the interaction doesn't start and stop. It just goes on forever because it's the evolution, if it's an energy eigenstate, it just evolves by a phase. And so that means that one of these delta functions at zero, delta of zero is infinity, and the one in the energy direction is expressing the fact that you're getting a crazy answer which says that this thing is formally infinite because you use a plane wave. And what's really going on is that there's the thing that makes sense in the for wave packets, the thing that makes sense is if you have an interaction, the interaction is happening locally in space and time because of the way we're looking at their Hamiltonian. And so if you didn't have a packet, you'd expect that the interaction, there'd be some interaction rate, which is the fundamental quantity, which is happening. It's also the interaction rate per unit volume is kind of the thing that should be fundamentally being governed by the Hamiltonian. And if you wait for it forever, then you're going to get a probability one that it's going to happen. But in perturbation theory, so then what's really happening is perturbation theory is failing if you wait for too long. But if you have a packet, which is a spread in energies, you'll see the interaction start to happen, but then you'll turn it off because the packets will no longer overlap. And so the thing that makes sense if you're going to formally calculate in using energy eigenstates, which you can do if you're interested only in these things that are independent of the initial and final states in the end of the day, as it's argued in chapter 3, the thing that will make sense in the large time limit will be the rate rather than the total probability, because if you, the more your packet is flat, the more the probability is just going to, you've got a fixed probability per unit time, and it's just adding up over very, very, very long times to give you an infinite answer, which is what this delta function at zero is telling you here. So the thing you want to be calculating is the probability per unit time, and that's the thing that's simply related to the matrix element M. And so let me get the numbers right. That's given by M squared over 2E. So there's this, first of all, there's a delta function that goes along for the ride, 2 pi to the fourth delta. Times the absolute value of the matrix element. This is the energy of the initial state, times d beta, where d beta is my shorthand for the momentum integrals normalized in the funny way that we've been normalizing them. So it's just, this is d3p, product over all the particles in the final state, d3p divided by twice their energy, and there's probably a factor of 2 pi running around there. 2 pi cubed. So now for decay rates, you see the story. What we're going to do is take the interaction Hamiltonian from the standard model, calculate the matrix elements in particle states using the properties of creation and annihilation operators, and in that way calculate this matrix element of S between initial and final particles. That's this. We're going to be interested in the case when something does happen, so we're never going to look at this piece. The rest of it we know is going to be involving a delta function which is expressing conservation of energy and momentum. So we'll just factor out this factor which we know has to be there. What's left we're going to call M. Once we know what M is, then we're supposed to square M. No more problems with delta functions squared because M was defined not to have a delta function in it. And then there's various normalization factors that come in getting the decay rate right. And what they're essentially doing is they're enforcing that this thing behaves properly under Lorentz transformations. Now this thing, you remember, was the D3P over E was the Lorentz invariant combination. And this delta function is Lorentz invariant because we're taking the four momentum, we're asking them to be equal. This M is Lorentz invariant, is going to turn out in practice, because these are essentially the Lagrange densities, and they're being integrated over all space, so this thing looks like an action. The thing that's not Lorentz invariant here is just this 1 over E, and that's expressing time dilation. That if you're in the rest frame of the particle, this would be M, but if you're not in the rest frame of the particle, this is something which is bigger than M, making the whole rate smaller, which is just expressing the fact that if you see a particle that's moving through you, moving past you and decaying, it lives longer than you would have thought because it's time dilation, relativistic time dilation makes it live longer. So this is just basically, all the energy dependence is coming from Lorentz covariance, and really what you're learning here are what the 2 pi's and the 2's are. And this is just like, I want to make sure we're all using the same conventions when we calculate any rates. There's a whole bunch of technical issues that I'm completely ignoring here. And one of them is, I think the one that normally comes up in the not being unitarily equivalent is this limit. T goes to infinity, I'm taking very blithely like it's an easy limit to do. But typically these things are phases. So that's a very, very delicate limit to take. And again, the packets are what make it make sense at the end of the day. But if you take that limit seriously, then you know, this unitary transformation that I'm describing, in the hard, if you really take that limit seriously without the packets, then you'll find that the states that you're going to get are orthogonal to all the states you started off with. That's the typical thing that happens when things are not unitarily equivalent. And the short version of that message is that if I were a mathematician, I would worry about that. But that's never been important in the history of physics since, you know, God created physicists, because those issues are almost always to do with convergence of convergence issues are what I'm saying is not quite right, but it's morally true that the there's a whole school of mathematical physics which was built around what they used to call, there was a name for it, which if I didn't, I haven't had my drugs yet, so I can't remember. Axiomatic quantum field theory, that's what it was. These are good drugs. And so they were hung up on issues like unitary inequivalence of the, you know, interaction representation doesn't exist is what basically people were proving. And I think it's fair to say that nothing has come out of that, you know, in 40 years of, or 50 years now of axiomatic quantum field theory, no one's learned anything they didn't already know before. And then people go and they build a theorem around what people discover elsewhere, and then they and the reason for that is the same thing as, you know, the same reason that people don't worry about analysis too much when they're doing classical mechanics and physics, because the thing that the theorems are all tied up with are limits which are typically irrelevant for physics, because physics can't tell you the difference between a continuous function or one where, you know, various points are discretely separated from the rest of the points, which are the things that make all the analysis theorems hard for mathematicians. They don't make a difference for physicists because it's never a question that ever comes up physically. And these unitary inequivalence arguments are like that, that it's really true that perturbation theory, you know, you compare it to experiment, it works 10 decimal places. And if the mathematicians can't figure out how to define their limits to capture that, then so much the worse for the mathematicians. Yeah. It's not really a pressing issue for physics. There's, you know, the only kinds of limits that have, and the way that that's normally dealt with is that if you're really doing quantum mechanics where you have a finite number of degrees of freedom, then a lot of those limits are less subtle. And then you can see, and that's typically what you're really doing in physics, is you're dealing with some finite number of degrees of freedom. And so the limits that there's a large number of degrees of freedom is the one that typically has physical content. And so that and so those are the ones that are to do with renormalization and infrared divergences, and the ones that I kind of hit when I kind of alluded to when we're doing the vacuum energies. There's some limits which are really have some, they carry some physical information, and you want to keep track of them because they're telling you something about what the answer is, how it's changing as something varies, which is physically important. But most of these limits don't, they're just mathematical, you know. My personal take is that they're not pushing physics forward. They're helping the mathematicians understand what physicists do. Now, probably, you know, what I'm telling you is not the universal opinion of physicists. But I think the acid test is, you know, this stuff, these kind of issues have been around since the 30s. What have we learned from those kind of theorem issues that we didn't learn first elsewhere? And if something, my acid test of learning branches of physics is whether or not they've taught us anything new over decades. And if they have never done, then my ignorance is bliss. I would put string field theory in the same category. It's something which no one's ever learned anything from that you didn't already know. That might not have been what you were asking. But you might want to ask it again of you. I can't really see you with my glasses, so I should. I can't tell if you're rolling your eyes or not. Okay. All right, now so this is the key formula here. This one with this one. The main thing is you see the plan. The plan is we're just going to take matrix elements. And the Feynman, so what the plan will be that the Feynman rules are going to emerge by doing that. We just take some simple examples. And Feynman rules are just expressing the algebra of creation annihilation operators, which you get when you evaluate this matrix element using creation, the fact that you know what this is in terms of the Hamiltonian, which you know what it is in terms of the fields, and you know what that is in terms of creation annihilation operators. You know how they act on these states, so you can figure out what M is, plug it into here, and you're in business. And that Feynman rules are just giving you a very fast way of doing that. But that's all you're doing. All right. For two-party, alpha is a two-particle state, so then we're thinking of a collision process, then it's useful to define, so then the story is that if you collide, if you ask for what's the probability that an electron collides with a rock and gives me something else, it'll depend on, you know, did I shoot the electron at the rock or not? Part of the question depends on how you prepared the initial electron rock configuration. But then once they come together, the probability, you know, the rate for something to happen typically is the likelihood the electron hits the rock times the number of atoms in the rock or something. And so it's something which just scales with the number of atoms times some cross section which is intrinsic to, you know, electron atom interactions. And that's the thing that you'd like to extract, because that's the thing that's telling you about the interactions that were relevant and not about the how you happen to build your sample. So that's why cross sections are defined. There's a specific ratio. You want to define the cross section to be the rate for a reaction to happen divided by the probability it was to do with the initial state. And you'd like to do it in a way, in a Lorentz invariant theory, that the answer is Lorentz invariant. So in this case, it is convenient to divide the reaction rate. So again, you'd like to talk about a rate rather than probability by a factor which expresses the probability of having the reactants come together in the first place. With the goal of getting a result which is one independent of how the reactants are brought together, combined, and two Lorentz invariant. So we want it to make sense to say the cross section for such and such is such and such, and not have to say in detail what frame you measured the cross section. So the definition is the differential cross section for the rate alpha goes to beta. Beta could involve any number of particles you like. I should maybe put I equals 1 to n sub beta. So n sub beta is the number of particles in the final state. So long story short, so this is defined to be the differential rate for the reaction that alpha goes to beta divided by some factor f. And the factor f is being chosen to satisfy those two criterion over there. And so chapter 3 gives you the details, but the bottom line is that f is going to be basically the number density of particles that you're in state beta times the velocity with which they approach one another, times whatever you need to make the thing Lorentz invariant. Because the initial flux of particles is the thing that the reaction rate will depend on, which depends on how you prepared the system. So we're going to get m squared over f, 2 pi squared. So this is, again, there's the ubiquitous factor of 2 pi to the fourth is a delta function. The matrix element we have divided by f times d beta. I got everything. All right, so I need to tell you f and d beta. D beta is the same as it was before. So this is a product over the final state particles of d3p divided by 2 pi cubed times twice the energy. And f is 4 times the square root of, God, my memory is short. It's basically it's expressing the relative velocity of two particles is a Lorentz invariant concept, because the velocity of one particle depends on the frame you measure it in. But if you ask for the relative velocity of two particles, everybody agrees on that, because you've essentially said what frame you're measuring it in. You're measuring it in the frame, it's the velocity of one in the frame of the other. So you can express that in terms of the momenta of the two particles in state alpha in a Lorentz invariant way. And that's essentially where this expression is coming from. So it's p1 dot p2 squared minus m1 squared m2 squared. One way to say that, one way to think of that is that, so this is an aside. That kind of thing is coming in. F is proportional to the relative velocity. And one way to see why this combination appears in the relative velocity is if you imagine thinking of the, if you evaluate p1 dot p2, that's a Lorentz invariant thing. If you evaluate that in the rest frame of particle 1, let's say, that would be minus the mass of particle 1 times the energy of particle 2. So this is, and this energy is in the rest frame of 1. And so that would be minus the mass of particle 1, mass of particle 2, divided by square root of 1 minus v squared, the relative v squared. These are the initial state. This is all to do with the, this is F is the thing that's expressing, I'm dividing out the stuff that depends on the initial particles. And there was a, by assumption, we were only talking about a two-particle collision. So these are the two particles. So I'm trying to make something out of the properties of the two initial particles, which is, the basic statement is that the reaction rate, if we just calculate it, is proportional to this F. It's proportional to the number of particles we start off with, the density of particles we start off with, and it's proportional to their relative speed. Because they don't move towards each other, they don't react. And so you always, if you calculate this, you always find there's a there's an overall factor in the reaction rate, which is something which depends on how you, you shot them at each other. And so we're just dividing by that to be left with the thing that's the property of the interaction and not of the particular. So this gives you a formula for V rel in terms of the Lorentz invariant P1 dot P2 and the masses, which if you solve it is essentially this. So that's where that's coming from. So this is proportional to V rel. That's why it depends on P1 and P2 in that particular way. There's another factor there which is being stuck in to make this thing transform as a Lorentz scalar, which is basically the product of the energies of the initial states, which I haven't written here. That's why I've just written proportional to and not equal to. But that tells you exactly now how to calculate a cross-section given the matrix element, and the matrix element is the thing that you're, you know how to calculate given the Hamiltonian, which you know because you know what the standard model Hamiltonian is. Yeah. It's because the rate is the thing that is you're really asking why are rates the things which are important rather than probabilities. And again, you know, if we had been doing wave packets, probabilities would have been what you wanted. But it's because what I'm calculating here, I'm choosing these things to be particle states where they're labeled by momentum, so they're not wave packets. So I'm taking the, so if I had done this with wave packets, what you would have found is that if the wave packet is sufficiently peaked that it's, you more or less know the, what the momentum is up to the uncertainty principle, say. But it's not, what you want your wave packet to be is you want it to be more sharply peaked than the cross-section is, because you're trying to measure the cross-section as a function of energy, say. And if your wave packet is so broad that you can't see the energy dependence of the cross-section, you haven't done a very good job measuring anything. So you're normally asking for wave packets to, if your cross-section varies with energy or particle properties like that, you want your wave packet to be something which is an energy like that. But you can make it arbitrarily small because of the uncertainty principle, but then typically you're nowhere near the uncertainty principle limit. And in this limit, if you did the wave packet story, you would have gotten a probability that was interesting. But it would have been, it would have had the property that it was a product of stuff to do with this wave function times an amplitude which was a function of energy, which would have been the kind of thing you would have expected to get. The thing that this wave function multiplies would have been something you would have expected to get if you just use an energy eigenstate, which is what we're actually doing when we calculate things. We're using energy eigenstates everywhere because I'm using momentum to label the particles at the end of the day. So the statement is the probability you want is related to the thing that you would calculate with an energy eigenstate times something to do with this wave packet, which I'm not telling you about at all. So I'm focusing now on just the thing that you're, if we didn't have a wave packet. So since given I know things are going to factorize, the logic is let's calculate this with a wave packet, which is without a wave packet, using an effective energy eigenstate, which was these alpha, these in and out states I was talking about here, which are really energy eigenstates. And then the thing is that probability, for energy eigenstates, probability won't be the right thing to think about, because the thing that made probability turn on and off is that the wave packet kind of, they passed each other and then all the interactions stopped. If you're using this mathematical trick of using energy eigenstates, which you can do because of this, what's really going on behind the board is packets, then for the energy eigenstates, the wave packets never, the interactions don't ever stop because everybody's living everywhere throughout all of space and they're going on forever and they just interact as long as you like. So that the thing you would calculate if you tried to calculate the probability was not going to be very interesting because it's really not the thing that's going to be capturing the physics of things go by each other quickly and then they perturbatively, there's some rare probability they'll interact at all. But if you calculate the rate, That's the thing which has the, that's the thing which is going to be what would have appeared next to the phase function, because that's the thing, the rate is something which is small. The rate per unit time is small because there's a characteristic time frame over which this interaction is going to want something to happen. And if you just sit there with a wave packet which is arbitrarily broad, you're going to see it happen eventually for sure. But all you're really trying to do is capture a physical process where there was some small probability of having it happen. And that's why perturbation theory made sense to do. So if you're just trying to capture that factor, then the thing you need to be calculating is the rate, because the probability doesn't make sense if you're using energy eigenstates. Yeah, if you want the real rate, what you would do is you'd want to know the flux that this probability, this packet is telling you. The flux stuff is what the packet would be telling you about. And so that's kind of one reason why we divide out by the flux. This thing is going to be, you could calculate the rate, but because we're interested in the thing that doesn't depend on how you brought the packets together, and we divide it out by the stuff which is all packet dependent, we're allowed to calculate it with these energy eigenstates. But the thing we're going to be having to use is these rates, because if we're doing this calculation with energy eigenstates, you know, the total rate would make sense. The total probability would make sense, but it would always be one if you didn't have a packet. And so perturbation theory wouldn't be useful. But the perturbative calculation of the rate makes sense as long as you calculate the rate. But the perturbative calculation of the probability wouldn't make any sense. Wouldn't be a good approximation of the real answer if you're using energy eigenstates. But we know in the process we're really interested in, the perturbative thing is actually relevant because they only interact briefly. So the rate is more useful. Yeah. This F here or this F here? This is the Lorentz invariant, right? This is it's a product of 2-4 vectors. This is P dot here means P1 mu, P2 mu. So it's really the Lorentz invariant dot product. And you can kind of see that from here, that I'm taking the Lorentz invariant dot product here, evaluating in the rest frame of particle 1, and it depends on the velocity of particle 2 in particle 1, which is the relative velocity. And the relative velocity is what the cross section is going to depend on. So it really is a Lorentz invariant. This is the difference between capital F and F is really that this is a Lorentz invariant. Any other questions? I'm skating over things here, so. There, capital F does. Capital F has that in here. When I'm writing here, when I write F, let me just make sure I haven't lied to you. So F is defined. The definition of little f is it's actually -4. So if I just write this, this is really -4 p1 dot p2 times v rel. That's the definition of it. And capital F differs from little f by, I think capital F is little f, it's this divided by E1 over E2. So the thing is that the E1 over E2 is there to make this thing Lorentz invariant. And so the P1 dot P2 over E1 or E2 is a thing which is one in the rest frame of one of the particles. So the logic is you choose F to be, F is basically the flux of particles in the rest frame of one or two. And then in a general frame, you just define F to be whatever it has to be to make this thing transform as a Lorentz invariant. And so the V rel is expressing the flux part. And this divided by E1 over E2 is the thing that's saying that the answer is V rel in the rest frame, but it's transforming the right way in a general frame to make this thing Lorentz invariant. Because P1 dot P2 over E1 E2 is something which is one in the rest frame of either particle, but it's something which is not Lorentz invariant. But its failure to be Lorentz invariant is exactly what you needed to make this thing Lorentz invariant. Which is, you know, argued in more detail in the chapter 3. But it's that's the logic to it. Okay, can I move on? this is, again, one of those times when there's a whole subject here that I'm just skating over because this is not really what this course is about. But the main formulas are this one, and then the expression for M in terms of the interaction Hamiltonian, which you know because you know what S is in terms of the matrix elements of the Hamiltonian. So now let's do an example. So this is kind of, this is the last day we're meeting. So I want to do, the bulk of this course normally is about just working through examples of this because almost everything there is to know about the standard model is a special case of this kind of a calculation. And all field theory perturbative calculations come down to special cases of this kind of thing. So let's calculate the decay rate for Z goes to something. Anything. So that's a particle that lives in the standard model. It's heavy. It's got, it does decay. Most heavy things will decay if they can. And so the first thing we want to know is we want to use this expression where alpha is a Z particle. So we're supposed to use alpha as, you know, a Z particle with some momentum and some spin, which is the creation operator for that Z particle on the particle state. And beta is anything that we can get from the Hamiltonian. Now, the thing that's going to dominate, of course, we can't calculate everything, but what we want to know is what's the dominant thing to some accuracy. And so that's where the perturbation theory is going to come in. We know, if we knew what M was, we'd be in business, so we want to calculate S. But we know S is given by 1 minus I times the integral d4x times the interaction Hamiltonian, you know, plus minus I squared over 2 integral d4x1, d4x2, time order product of h interaction of x1, h interaction of x2, and so on. So the idea is that if we find a matrix element, you know, for decay, what we know about beta is that it's not alpha, right? So we're interested in focusing on betas which are not alpha, so that's one for which the 1 is going to drop out. So we're going to start off with minus I integral d4x beta h interaction of x alpha, this other stuff. Plus, let me write it, I guess, once here. And the idea is that if perturbation theory in this interaction is good, things for which this is non-zero will win, because these ones are going to be involved the square of some small thing, whereas this is linear in some small thing. But if there happens to be true that there's nothing for which this is non-zero, then we'll have to start here. And so the logic of the first few calculations would be, I chose this reaction rather than the reaction, say, where a muon decays, because in a standard model, it happens here. Whereas when a muon decays, it turns out that it happens first here, at second order in the interactions. And so I'm just giving you these examples in kind of successively more complicated steps. So for this particular reaction, it'll turn out that there's a contribution here. And so that should be the leading description of what the Z decays into. And if we want a really detailed prediction, we'll have to include these higher order corrections. But it should be good enough to stop here. And you'll see that actually this stopping here does a really good job of what you actually see when you watch Z decay. So, since we're asking for a reaction where the Z is initially there, but is no longer there when we're finished, that kind of shows that we're looking for an interaction in the standard model where there's only one Z field in the problem, because we want it to destroy the Z particle that we start off with. So the only interaction, and it's useful to sit down with a standard model Lagrangian and look at all the places a Z appears and ask where, what ones involve only one Z. So it has to destroy a Z, and it has to leave only particles lighter than the Z. That's because if it's not lighter than mz, then the energy momentum conservation delta function can't be satisfied. So this will always be zero, and so that the rate will be zero, even if the matrix element is not zero. So the interaction with is, it's the neutral current interaction that we saw already. So we had a neutral current interaction, which was, there's a sign here, which I'm going to get wrong probably. It was IE over sine theta W cos theta W Z mu sum over fermion of fermion bar gamma mu. There's a T3 gamma left minus a Q sine squared theta times the fermion. So T3 and Q depended on the fermion. It was a third matrices, right? So the sign isn't going to make a difference for what I'm going to do now, but let me just get it right. And I had a 50-50 chance, and I got it right. I got it right, actually. Good. So so what we wanted, though, was the Hamiltonian, not the Lagrangian. And so then here again, there's a story that I'm skating over. So, but so you need to know there's a story here, but I'm not going to give you a whole bunch of satisfaction on it. We want H. Now, so the right thing to do would be to go to use the canonical framework to calculate the Hamiltonian from the Lagrangian and figure out what it is. So you remember, you know, the Hamiltonian is something like the momentum times the Q dot. So Hamiltonian would have been Pi Q dot I minus L or something like that, summed over all the things involved. And so if the interaction term did not involve derivatives and it did not involve spin 1 particles, because spin 1 particles tend to come with derivatives, then it would have been true that for the interaction Hamiltonian, so it's sometimes true, sometimes H interaction is minus L interaction. But not always is that true. And in particular, that's not true when you have a derivative interaction, as you see in the exercise that you're doing in your homework. And it's typically not true also when you have a spin 1 particle for a similar reason in your interaction. But in the cases where this is not true, when there's a derivative interaction and there's a spin 1 interaction, it's also true that the difference here is typically stuff which is not even Lorentz invariant. And so it's stuff which would have made the whole answer not Lorentz invariant if it hadn't been canceled by something else, and it is canceled by something else. It's canceled by a failure of the time-ordered product. This time-ordered product is also not Lorentz invariant. If you have, for instance, one way to see that in the example that you do in your homework, if it happened that you had the time-ordered product of two scalar fields, normally, why would you believe a time ordering is Lorentz invariant? You know, in relativity, if you have two points, so we have two fields interacted at two points, or evaluated at two points, or say beta alpha, two points, to agree on the time ordering, we have to agree, for this to be Lorentz invariant, all observers would have to agree on the time ordering. But we know that for spatially separated, for space-like separated points that are outside of each other's light cone, that different people disagree on the ordering of events in time, right? Now the good news is that as long as these guys commute, when they're space-like separated, you don't care what their ordering is, because all we're arguing about is who's to the left of whom, and if they commute, then it doesn't make a difference who's to the left of whom. And for most space-like separations, these things do commute, because that was a big story there. We wanted to design these various field operators so that they had a creation part and then a destruction part, and that's kind of why antiparticles had to exist. They had to be there to make these things commute when they're space-like separated. But when x1 and x2 are equal to each other, that's a case where they don't actually commute, and there's a problem. And so when you, if you ask, is it Lorentz invariant for these things to calculate something like this, it can be. But if it's not, it'll typically, the problem will arise when x1 and x2 are sitting on top of each other. If x1 and x2 are time-like separated, then there's no problem. This will be Lorentz invariant because everybody agrees on the ordering of events in the time-like direction, because that's what causality is being dictated, is requiring us to do. So let's. It turns out that if we took two scalar fields here, this is, and we took the no particle state here, that's something which is Lorentz covariant. It happens. But you can kind of see there's going to be a problem if we start differentiating this, like you do in the assignment. If you differentiate d mu, if this is Lorentz covariant, then this should also be Lorentz covariant. And if the derivative did not hit the time ordering, if it only hit the fields, that would mean that this would be Lorentz invariant. But you remember this time ordering involves step functions, which depended on, we had these guys in this order with a step function for the time of this one minus the time of this one. And then we had in the other order with a step function with the other time. The derivative will hit that step function, and it's going to give you delta functions in time. And that's, again, telling you there's a problem when these guys are right on top of each other. And so it happens that for scalar fields, this is Lorentz covariant, and the derivative is Lorentz covariant. But that means that this cannot be Lorentz covariant, because the difference between this and this is when the derivative hits the time ordering. And so, in general, if you have interactions involving derivatives, the time ordering of those things is not Lorentz covariant. And that could be ruining Lorentz covariance. Let me just finish the thought. These things that are not Lorentz covariant here, the difference between this and this exactly cancels the difference between this and this, it turns out. And so you never have to worry about it. It's something which is always going to, the mistake you make by taking this to be true is going to cancel the failure you make by using this instead of this. And there's a similar statement for spin 1 particles. And that's kind of a big deal. It's, again, one of these things where Jesus died for your sins. You don't want to do it every day, given you know it's going to actually work all the time. And the whole point of a path integral derivation of quantum field theory is that it makes this cancellation not happen. You don't have to worry about it. It's the way you calculate it is directly in terms of the Lagrangian, and the time orderings you get is always the one that's covariant and not the one that's literally the time ordering. And so this is sometimes defined to be a T star product, where that means that these things are not exactly the same, but they, or this is defined to be this, but it's not the same as a regular time ordering because of the difference is the derivative acting on the time ordering. So the message is for in practice is that if you're calculating, you can use this as if it was true, and when you do time ordered things as you're going to have to do because time ordering appears everywhere here, you can forget about the fact that there's a failure of things to time order and there's failure for things to be Lorentz invariant in the time ordering, and you can implicitly use the time ordering, which is Lorentz invariant. And those two mistakes you made will cancel each other in the answer and give you a Lorentz invariant answer. And you never need to think about it again. Yeah? Well, you just differentiate that. If I take, time ordering of operator, I could have taken different operators there, right? So we have O1 of X, O2 of Y. That was O1 of X, O2 of Y. Those are O's times a step function, X naught minus Y naught. Plus or minus, depending on these are bosons and fermions of O1 of Y, O2 of X times a step function of Y naught minus X naught. I differentiate that, I have to differentiate these things. And so I'm going to get something which is going to involve operators and delta functions. The derivative of a step function is delta function. And that thing is just going to be there. And it could be that for some operators, the thing it multiplies by is zero, like you're saying, that it's not going to make a difference because these things are commute, basically. But you can see when I differentiate this thing, I'm going to pick up d mu of all that will be delta mu 0, because it's only going to be with time that I'm differentiating, times delta of x naught minus y naught, times the difference of these, or the sum or difference of these operators. O1, OX, OY, minus the other one, or plus the other one. And so this is something which looks really non-covariant, and it is non-covariant. But it may or may not be important, depending on what this thing is doing. So for scalar fields, it turns out that it's covariant anyway, because what you said happens. That it's if I had just done this time ordering, the thing that multiplies the delta function is something which is zero, so I don't care. But for other things, like in this case, it turns out it's not zero, and so then you have to worry about it. But if you did worry about it, it would cancel the failure you made here. And that's why if you go back to these old, it used to be that people thought field theory with quantum electrodynamics as the example, because that was the one everyone understood the best. And it's one of these ones that's actually very complicated, because it does have a spin one particle. The Hamiltonian in this case has a Coulomb interaction, which is not covariant, plus other things. It looks really ugly. And then you calculate with that matrix elements, and there's a cancellation that this non-covariant Coulomb interaction starts to cancel other things that are coming in, which they used to call Seagull terms, which are these time ordering stuff. And those things, you never would have, the whole point of these calculations is you want to make them look as simple as possible at every step along the way so you can catch mistakes. And it was very difficult to do them in the way that people were doing them. And the path integrals are just, the only reason they're useful is that they set the problem up in a way where this cancellation, you don't have to even think about it, because you're just doing things in terms of the Lagrangian right from square one. So you should be aware that there's an issue here, and be aware that once the issue is resolved, you don't have to think it through every time, because it really is canceling for an important reason. And in practice, that means that for this calculation, we can just go ahead and just use this. But not always. But who cares? Because in the end of the day, Jesus dies for your sins, and you get to use the fact that these things are not the same. So let me just write the next few lines, and then we'll stop. So in this case, what do we want to do? So the thing we're looking for, in this case, what are we expecting? Here's an operator which creates a Z boson and destroys a Z boson, because it's a sum of two terms. We're looking for a matrix element which has a Z boson on the right, no Z boson on the left, so we're going to ask for the destruction part of this thing. And then the rest of it has to come from this. So what this thing is going to do, it's going to be acting on a no particle state, because the only particle there was taken care of by this field, so it's going to create something. So they both F and F bar had a creation part and a destruction part. We're interested in this case in the creation parts, because we're looking for a matrix element which is not zero. And so we're going to be interested in when F creates an antiparticle, and when F bar creates a particle. So that says right away that the only matrix element, this matrix element need not be zero, but it will only not be non-zero for the final state, which is a fermion and an anti-fermion pair. So the only non-zero matrix element of the form beta L neutral current alpha or Z is for beta equals to fermion with some momentum, you know. What am I using now as my convention here? So I would rather use K, I think, for the Z momentum, because that's what I'm going to do in the future. And I'll say P for the fermions. So P sigma P bar sigma bar. And so what we want is we want F P sigma F bar sigma bar of L interaction, L neutral current of X and once we have that, we know that the matrix element we're looking for is going to be, the one term is not there. I had minus IH, the Hamiltonian, but that's going to be plus IH, the Lagrangian, if I use the Hamiltonian as minus the Lagrangian. Minus that minus. So I'll have plus I over n factorial, but n is 1, on the integral t4x. So we calculate this, plug it into this, that gives us the matrix element, which will be, and tell us what M is, and then we can use M to calculate the K rate. And so the last step you need for this matrix element, which is what I want to write down, yeah? I just thought that's what I'm calling the momenta for this is the momentum of the outgoing fermion, and p bar is the momentum of the outgoing antifermion. And sigma is the spin in the anti. So that's just how I'm labeling my states. So to do this matrix element, we need to use what we already know. This is the integral. This is the sum over spins integral d3k of, and here I'm going to be, the conventions I'm going to want to use are not the ones in the book. So be it. So the square root of 2 pi cubed twice the energy. Polarization vector UVI KX, destruction operator, plus the complex conjugate. And the fermion, you remember, was similarly sum over spins, or I've used sigma, let me use lambda. And in my convention, I think I had no, I didn't keep the two pi's here. I think they were buried in these u's. So what do I go? Instead of al, let me call this c p lambda, plus the antiparticle part, which was v of p sigma p lambda. I should not use P here. Let me use L because I shouldn't use K here because that's something which is the external thing. Let me use, let me call that one L. Sorry. And let me use Q or something for instead of P here. Now the antiparticle Q lambda star. And F bar has a similar thing, right? So there's F bar will, it'll be, the difference will be that we'll have U bar e to the minus I QX C star Q lambda. Then we'll have V bar e to the I QX C bar Q lambda. So now it's algebra, right? You plug this into this. Read off the matrix element, plug that into the decay rate, and then you're in business. So most of this is now just the mechanics of how do you manipulate these polarization vectors and these spinners in the matrix element. Let me just write down what this becomes. So you should check this, but I want to have something I can start from next time. So FP sigma F bar P bar sigma bar current of X all that's going to happen is we get to this goes along to the ride the IE over sine theta cos theta the Z I have to focus on the destruction part of the Z boson because it's supposed to destroy a Z boson so I have to kill this guy. So the destruction part of the Z is coming from this term. So this coefficient here is going to go along for the ride. So we'll have you know, epsilon mu. And now what we'll get is this coefficient, but this thing will only destroy the Z boson in the initial state if L is equal to K and if zeta is equal to C, because it has to destroy the momentum and spins that were available there. Otherwise, remember, this thing acting on a particle state is proportional to a delta function. It gives you, you know, A L zeta on a state involving momentum K and spins C was a delta function, delta 3 of K minus L, delta C zeta times the no particle state. That just says that you had to destroy the right particle. And there were factors of 2 pi and energy in the normalization that's in the book that I'm not keeping track of here. And so this thing will give me a delta function, and that delta function I can use to do this integral, the d3l integral. So everywhere I have an l, I can replace it by the particle momentum that was in the initial state. Everywhere I see a zeta, I can replace it by the c, which is the spin of the initial z particle. So here I can write this as being epsilon mu k of c divided by 2 pi cubed times twice the energy of the function k, square root. All right, and then same story here, that F, I have to write the piece which creates the antiparticle, and F bar, I have to write the piece which creates the particle. So in F, I'm interested in this term, and in F bar, I'm interested in this term, because that's where the creation is going on. Once I've created something, the particle I create has to be the one that's there in the matrix element, right? So I have to create it with momentum P bar, the antiparticle momentum P bar, and spin sigma bar, and so on. So the same delta function story that happened here for the Z particle is going to happen for the final state fermions as well. So I can use those to do these integrals D3Q and D3Q bar, and that'll give me something which is involving all these things will be evaluated at the momentum of the final particles here. So the fermion bar, the field on the left there, here, will give me a U bar, and it's going to be evaluated at the, it's creating the particle, so it's going to have momentum P sigma. It'll have a, I forgot to write the e to the I kx, and here we're going to get an e to the minus I p times x from that factor. And then we have, so that's, those are the things coming from inside the field operator here. Now we have the gamma matrices, which I can just write down as they are. So we'll have gamma mu p3 for the fermion, whatever that number is, times gamma left minus q for the fermion times sine squared theta w. And now we have the factors that are coming from the F operator, which is this guy. So we'll have v for the antifermion times e to the minus I q bar x. Right? And that's it. And the sum and the integral have been done by the delta functions. And that's the thing we have to evaluate. And so we can group the and I've used here the conventions that I've got, which are not the ones from the notes. So I should probably correct for that now. That's a convention for U. Conventionally, those are buried in the U's here. And so I just need to remind myself what the convention in the book was. Because that's not the convention I normally use. So let me just write down. Yeah, so if you use the conventions of the book, then these were all defined to be in the states, and so that those are just not, those factors are just not there. That's why they're useful, is that it makes these formulas look cleaner. You don't have to carry the square root of energy around. So one last thought I want to leave you with is that all these e to the ix's we can separate out, right? So this is factors e to the i e sine theta cos theta. That's that factor. I've got a polarization vector epsilon mu, depending on k and zeta, or c, sorry. I've got the spinner, u bar, depending on p and sigma, times gamma matrices, gamma mu, t3, gamma left, minus q sine squared theta, times v, u bar, sigma. So this is all the Dirac spin stuff, right? This is a Dirac matrix bar summed into a gamma matrix times a Dirac column vector. And then the phases here are, go along for the ride. We have e to the I k minus p minus q times x. And what are we going to do with this thing? We're going to integrate it over all x. And that's going to give us a delta function, which we knew had to be there, the momentum conserving delta function. So we're going to use it, the integral d4x of e to the I k minus p bar. That's supposed to be p bar. X. That's because this was supposed to be a P bar. That's just 2 pi to the fourth, delta to the four of K minus P bar. So this is the factor that we always expect to be there. And so that allows us to write this thing as 2 pi to the fourth minus I times 2 pi to the fourth times a delta function k minus p bar times a matrix element. And this is what we want. Matrix element for z goes to f, f bar. So that is just coming from the integral here. So we can just ignore this factor. And then the final thing I want to write is what this matrix element is. And then we're business. So m is going to be, just ignore these e to the ikx's. Keep this thing. There's an overall minus sign that was in the definition here. It was minus I. I'm worried about there being a. I'm worried about the i's, but let's just live with it. So we've got minus e over sine theta cos theta epsilon mu kxc u bar. Yeah, but I did that with, that's why I put an I, a plus I here. Oh, that's probably, so that's, no, that's good. No, you made me happy. The I's are working, though. I forgot this I here. So this I is that I. All I have to do is keep track of the minus sign. So I have to keep that I. I was worried about that I, so that's the thing that I'm really. Gamma mu. And that's it. Right? So now the rest of the battle is we just take this thing, we square it, and we put it into that expression for the decay rate. And that means we have to square this thing. So that's part of the mechanics that I'll do in the afternoon. And then we have to integrate it over D3 final state. And that was D3P, D3P bar. And so that's what I'll do in the very next this afternoon. Any questions about that?